Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Hi guys, so it's Anna David here. Wow, there's some screaming in the background. Do you hear that? It's not the voices in my head. That's actual screaming. Well, hey, so I'm feeling good. I'm on a bit of a sugar high of sorts because I just returned from having frozen yogurt. Come on, tell me you hear that screaming. Anyway, frozen yogurt with the guest that I'm about to delight you with. And all I can say about her, I mean, there's a lot I can say about her, but chief among those things I can say is the fact that she's just the girl you want to go and have frozen yogurt with, like, all the time. I get into this in the podcast, but she, dealing with her taught me a lot about what I wanted to be like when people were dealing with me. Her gratitude and her sweetness is infectious and extremely admirable. And so, yeah, we just had frozen yogurt and then sat on the street where she told me about a whole bunch of other people that she thought would be great for this podcast. That's the kind of gal I'm talking about. Sarah Benincasa is her name. It's also a very fun name to say. Benincasa. Four syllables. The last two, if we were playing charades, and this was in Mexico, means house. And that's not how you play charades anyway. And I don't speak Spanish, but I know that. I think that what is fascinating about her is that this is not somebody that you would interact with or know or stand on the street eating frozen yogurt with and go, oh, well, that's definitely a person with mental illness. And that's sort of the point, which is to say that, it takes people from jail and people from Yale. I didn't make that up. That's like a total recovery expression, which blew me away the first time I heard it, and then it sounded just dumb when I just said it now, but a little pretentious too, but a little extreme. I mean, if I'm gonna really get into critiquing it, but anyway, the point is that people who suffer from addiction, from mental health issues, from any number of these things don't all look the same way. And if they are dealing with them and those issues are being treated, they can be a sheer delight to deal with. And she is Exhibit A. I only knew she had these issues because she's very open about them. She's written this fabulous book, which has fabulous in the title. Very smart marketing. Agora Fabulous, which is her memoir about having agoraphobia. And she has a new book out. If it is not out at the moment you're hearing this, it's out any minute, or it just came out. You know what I mean? It's called Great. And it's a lesbian teen romp based on The Great Gatsby. And she's just awesome. And that's not the most articulate I've ever been, but you don't need me to be articulate because you have Sarah Benincasa today. What else do I want to tell you? I'm thinking of making this podcast weekly. Faithful listeners will recall that it was weekly once upon a time. And then I quickly got overwhelmed because I was building the whole after party site and feeling like I was going crazy. And so I moved it to bi-weekly because that gave me a little cushion, right? And then because I was always behind the eight ball and I was always just like, oh my God, I need someone right now. And because I decided it was going to post on Thursday night. And, nobody told me that. So these are all rules I'm making up. And sometimes when you're making up rules, you'd make decisions like, I'm going to make this every other week. So I am thinking of making it every week just because I feel like you build something up that way. And now I have a few in the bag. So I feel that I am luxuriating in all this cup runneth over business, and that I can. Of course, this does remind me a little bit of how I won't have money, and then I'll get a big check, and then I'll go buy everything and pay off my credit card bills, and then I have no money again. So I don't know if that's what I'm doing or if it's actually a healthy thing. Feel free to let me know. You're listening. I can see you downloading it, not you. Don't worry. Are you looking around your apartment right now and going like, is she here? Because that's not happening. I just mean that I'm looking at the numbers and I know you're downloading. So tell me, would you like it every week? Do you like the fact that I'm now talking to non-addicts about their mental health issues? Do you like the one mean review says, think I have an unfortunate personality? Or let's be clear, have what your mother would call an unfortunate personality, and wish I talked less. I mean, I did talk a lot less in this one because of that quote kind of, you know, being in my brain. But, you know, look, if you're going to say it nice. I mean, I think that the girl's got a point. She also did call out the fabulous guests I have, so she's right about that. But I'm not really, yeah, it's weird. I used to really take those in and really take those on and feel so sad and so hurt. And I don't know, but I remember that bothered me for like a good 10 minutes. And it bothered me when I read it. And then like on the 11th minute, it was sort of fine, but I'm still talking about it. So I guess you could say I'm still bothered by it, but I don't feel it the way I used to feel those things. And it does teach you about not really writing negative things about other people because it hurts a lot. And, you know, you sort of think you're just putting it out there and that's not a real person that's going to care if you read it. Or maybe some people put it out there because it is a real person who will care. But when I used to write mean things or just, not thoughtful things, and I had the experience of somebody telling me, the person I wrote it about telling me that they read it, and it sort of forever changed how I deal with that. But anyway, I don't need to tell you, you guys are not, you know, you're hardly trolls. Am I right? You guys are people who are interested in making your life better. So you probably know that going and writing nasty things to other people or mean reviews may give you that power surge for a second, followed inevitably by a not good feeling. So you're probably not doing that stuff. But maybe you have friends or relatives, loved ones who do it. And maybe you can share that knowledge with them. Who knows? Maybe some people it works. I have no real idea about anything. That's something I'm learning more and more. And what else am I learning more and more? I don't know. I guess just that, like, that I've been doing a kind of cool exercise where I write on one side of the page what the universe can control and on the other side of the page what I can control. I do this every morning after I meditate. God, that sounded so holier than thou. I'm just telling you what I'm doing. I've been directed to do this. It wasn't my idea. And I committed to doing it for 30 days. And I do think it does really help because I'll go into a situation kind of getting all it does more than anything, rather than making me aware of how little I control, because life teaches me that every second. What it teaches me, what it shows me on a daily basis is how what my anxieties are about a certain situation, how pleasing, say, a new boss or a writing partner matters to me, and to really look at it very clearly so that I at least go in knowing what I'm thinking. You know, I'm certainly never going to know exactly what the other person is thinking, but much of my life I've gone in not even knowing what I'm thinking about something, and it really helps a lot. And, you know, and we get into this in the podcast, but the importance of gratitude, the importance of if I'm going to find fault with anything anyone else is doing, first of all, it is not my place to dictate how anybody else should behave. And oh my God, I just totally lost my train of thought, which is great because we actually get into that too. Does medication make you forgetful? Do you guys know? Do you, if you try this writing down the universe versus you thing, will you tell me if it is fun or something? I don't know. I think I'm done with the ramble fest. And thank you for listening to After Party Podcast. Give us a review, a nice one. Check out After Party Chat. I can't believe I forgot what it was called. Where we are posting all the time now, our thoughts, feelings, and emotions. That's a little redundant about addiction and recovery. And please enjoy Sarah Benincasa. She is a sheer delight.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
you say is a gem.
I try to speak in quotes.
You do.
Well, I was talking to someone recently about friendship.
Yeah.
And I think it was my friend Will Weldon, who's a comedian, and he and I both do a TV show sometimes on Pivot
Take Part TV. Live.
Yeah, Take Part Live. And we were talking, and I was saying to him, I've learned that I have to manage my expectations with friends.
Right.
Because sometimes what I consider to be good friendship is not what someone else considers to be good friendship. And I've also been in the position where I was not doing enough for mm-hmm. someone else. Like, I was doing enough for me.
Right.
So a lot of relationships in general, I think, whether it's at work or with a friend or whatever, is finding someone for whom their enough is the same as your enough, and then being each other's enough.
It's so true. I go through that all the time, and my therapist has this story that she shares about, like, these two people who got in a fight, and the reason they got in the fight is this one woman expected the other woman to go get in her car and warm it up. And it's a ludicrous example, and I don't remember the rest of the story, but the point is, like, one person's expectation is, of course you would go and warm up the car while we're getting ready, whereas another person's like, what? Why would I do that?
Yeah, and like, that's weird.
And I'm always guilty of the warming up the car assumption. I assume people know that that's what good friends do. And it's gotten me, you know, into trouble. And, you know, I do feel like maturity is about getting that, like, what, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. And my expectations have to be leveled.
Mm-hmm. And that really is a big part of it. And figuring, I have a friend who is a comedian who's very busy, who doesn't really respond to text messages very much. And I thought it was me, and I was like, oh, I must be texting too much, which I'm very communicative, so of course it could be that.
Right.
I'm like, oh, maybe I'm trying too hard, I'm putting in too much effort. And then I happened to talk to another friend about it, who was like, no, that's just how this person is. They don't listen, they don't respond to text, they don't like to communicate through text or email, but so they just sort of check in a few times a week and will respond.
Right.
And that was so interesting to me. But there's also something, it's not the way I operate, but there's also something genuine about that, that this person really values, I think, face-to-face communication. And that's cool.
And isn't doing, like, the sort of people-pleasing rote response, yeah, because it's quote-unquote appropriate to respond to every text.
Yeah, you know? This is a pretty genuine person, which is cool, who really needs that, I think, face-to-face thing.
Right.
And it's not out of disrespect, and I think he's managing it and trying to be better with it, because he's apologized to me a couple times, but I think he apologized to everybody. This is just not his way.
He should send out a group text apology.
Yeah, he should just have, like, an apology template just constantly ready to be like, okay.
Did you know there's that thing, by the way, somebody was showing me, there's, like, this automatic thing you can do where you send an automatic response. Do you know about this in texting?
No, really?
It's just sort of like the story I just told about the warming up the car, that I only have, like, a quarter of the information accessible in my brain, so I shouldn't tell it. But yeah, it's you can have these organized, these set responses, and you just hit it, and it automatically goes out.
Oh, that's cool.
Somebody, it's like I still drink. Like, it feels like a very drunken memory, but I know just that it's just my brain is getting older and is tired.
I have a very poor memory for things like conversations and events, and it get not events. That's not true. If I need to remember, well, I can remember dates of major historical events and things like that.
Interesting.
But if somebody says, no, remember we talked about this, sometimes I'm like, no, we didn't. And sometimes I'm right, but sometimes they're right. So it makes arguments difficult, like with my boyfriend, because he'll be like, we discussed this and I said blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, did? And I sound like a stoner, like, what, bro?
You did? Just don't remember.
I don't remember. And I think that part of it is a self-protective thing. My mom does the same thing. You don't remember what you don't want to remember.
Yeah.
But for me, that has bled over into just not remembering a lot of stuff. So sometimes I don't remember good stuff as well as bad stuff.
Well, okay, this is not, this is a gotcha moment. We totally had a conversation about your puppy. I realize this is not, see? I mean, all you're probably doing right now is talking about your puppy, but we had this whole conversation and then you're like, guess what? I got a puppy.
See, that's me just like forgetting and
but
blanking.
But that's normal because I'm sure you're talking about it a lot.
I talk about it so much. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But, and it's not to do, that's the interesting thing that, because I know this, even though I know other people might not know this, I know this from my perspective. I know it's not because I didn't value the interaction with the person.
Right.
Some of the things simply don't imprint, and it's not because they weren't important either. Right. It's very strange. I think there's something wrong with my brain. And sometimes I get nervous and I start to Google like early signs of Alzheimer's, and I'm like, don't do it, Sarah. Don't do it. Don't do it. You're just going to freak out.
Well, okay. Interesting, because I wonder, because I take medication and you take medication.
Yes.
Don't you, since they don't know the long-term effects of these things, I sometimes do worry.
I remember being a kid and my mom started to take meds and noticing a distinct change in her memory. Like it dropped, like her ability to retain like some things did. So some of the stuff I talk about, I attribute to her just like not remembering because she didn't want to, you know, like, but some of it, I think she just genuinely doesn't remember, especially now with like menopause and stuff. I think that is just a natural thing that happens. And, but for me, I don't have the menopause excuse. So I'm like, well, I think the drugs probably have something to do with it. I honestly believe that in 10 years, a study is going to come out that really says this is really, and you and I are going to look back at certain relationships that we had and be like, oh, I should call that person who I haven't talked to in 10 years and be like, this is why, this is why.
Right. But I mean, I don't know about you, but I am like, whatever, even if I find out, not if I find out like we'll grow like an arm out of our head at the age of 75, there's very little that I could find out that would make me go, oh, well, I regret having done this.
Oh yeah. I talked to a shrink who was talking to me about the potential for, certain birth defects if you are taking a high dose of this particular drug in the first 3 months of the first trimester. And, you know, I'm not trying to get pregnant or anything, but maybe I want to someday. I don't know. And honestly, my reaction was like, all right, just another reason to pursue adoption.
Yeah, I had the same response. Man. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's so funny. It's like I used to have that about smoking cigarettes. I remember reading this study when I graduated from college and it said smoking cigarettes and taking the pill is like putting a loaded gun to your head. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh shit, I have to go off the pill. Like it didn't even occur to me to go the other way.
Just like, And it's because it's when the when whatever benefit you gain from some substance outweighs like the risk, you're just going to go for it.
Right. And, which is the exact
And with us
problem.
Taking meds, that's a good thing though.
I know. Usually it's not a good thing.
Usually it's not. But in this case, it is a very good thing. I think. I mean, you know, if you want to, if it's really important to you to have a biological baby of your own,
right,
then I can understand that medication would not be worth it. But for me, I used to be like, I just don't need it to be my own child because I'm really enlightened. But really, it's not that. It's just some of it is also that I'm not sure I actually want to like carry a child.
Well, there's that.
Some of it's really like, do I want to do that? I want to be, if I'm a mom someday, I want to be a good mom. But, you know, the kid doesn't have to have my genetic material.
Right.
But you got to be financially stable for that. And so that, like,
you got to be financially stable for both.
True. Absolutely for both. And so I think I'll probably, if I become a mom, it's not going to be anytime soon.
Right.
Unless I get a windfall of cash and suddenly I'm feeling really fertile.
But don't you love how people are like, oh my God, you have all these books. You are so successful.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, but I also, you know, borrowed money from my parents like a few months ago.
But you are doing so well. I mean, you are actually like resentment worthy.
Oh, and okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, right?
That's exciting.
But you're so lovely that you're impossible to resent. Okay, I do. I'm not laying this on. This is my honest to God feelings about you having just, you know, started to get to know you in the last year. I did that show for 2 years. So I interacted with many women. You were so universally lovely in every interaction. It taught me actually a lot. It's funny because we were talking about emails when you walked in. And it literally, I was like, this is how I want people to feel about interacting with me, the way I feel interacting with Sarah.
That's so great. Thank
it's
you.
It's so true. Like, because people were nice a lot. I mean, obviously, this was like a chummy show. I liked all the women.
It's so fun.
But there was just this way you had of always responding quickly, always responding with genuine gratitude and just no ego. And it was so lovely. And so I just came to start loving dealing with you. And
gratitude is very important to me.
Very clearly. Because it shows.
Very important. It's like the only religion that I ascribe to that I can really get down with. Like,
tell
I don't
me
know
about
if I believe
that.
In God. I really don't. Sometimes right. I'm like, I'm sensible. I don't believe in God. And then other times I think, I want to believe in God. I love. And I have an altar in the corner of my house. But then I'm also like, I don't believe in God. You know, it's very complicated. But gratitude is very important to me because I think that people. As soon as you forget to be grateful, then you start being less fun to be around. That doesn't mean that you have to bow and scrape. Like,
right.
It doesn't mean that you have to be like, oh my God, I'm so glad that you, why would you ever think that I would be worthy of, you know, contributing to this anthology? It's like, no, I can be confident in the fact that I'm a good writer and I'm funny, but also be grateful that you gave me this opportunity to participate in this cool thing. Like that's, it took me a while to get there because for a long time I was just so thankful for any kind of attention or anything. I was like, I'm so grateful. But then as I've gotten older, I've realized, no, I have something to offer and this
right.
is a good thing. But it's also really, I just am very appreciative. And I think part of that also comes from having had a nervous breakdown when I was 21 and having really have been suicidal a few times in my life.
Right.
And being really, I've learned to be very grateful for the times that I feel good. And it's not that I'm constantly dreading the bad times like I used to.
Right.
I just accepted that sometimes I'm probably going to feel like shit because life is life and that's life.
Right.
But
right.
I'm so grateful when there's good things that I get very happy about that.
I think that's rare. I think, well, let's talk about the mental illness. So you, and the nervous breakdown.
Sure.
So you, there you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Happy-ish Italian family.
Yes, happy-ish Italian fam.
Brother, sisters?
My brother, Steve.
Brother, Steve, older?
Younger. He's 3 years younger.
Interesting.
And he was this, like, good time guy when we were growing up. Like, you know, he was always just, like, smoking pot and, like, doing it with chicks and being
right.
cool and being popular. And he was so fun and everybody liked Steve. And I was the one who was like, I'm weird and have emotional issues. And he was just like, whatever, Mom. I'm going to the party. And I was like, oh, Steve, you're really rebellious. And so I like resented him, but at the same time I admired him.
Right.
And he was never really, I'm just like so proud of him because he was never, there was nothing that everybody was, like, I always wanted to write. That was always my thing.
Right.
A lot of kids have a thing. He never had a one thing that everybody was like, Steve likes that. He just was like, whatever, bro. And he went to school for business.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told my parents, basically, I'm moving back in so that I can afford to go back to school, and I'm going back to school and I'm going to become a nurse, and I'm going to work with people with developmental disabilities. No, first it was the nurse thing. He was like, I'm going to be a nurse. And we were like, what are you talking about? And he was like, well, I've been listening to a lot of health podcasts at my job that is dumb, that I don't like, that does not like in bring me joy in any way. And then I started taking books out of the library about health and biology and stuff, and started looking at like med textbooks, and I'm going to be a nurse. And we were like, what the fuck?
Right.
Like cool dude, McCool dude wants to what? And then he was like, I decided I'm going to specialize in working with people with developmental disabilities. And we were even more like, what? So he manages a home now for, I think he has 4 girls. Who women 18 to in their 40s, I think, who have developmental disabilities.
Like,
and
what kind?
One is, I believe, has autism.
Mm-hmm.
Another has Down syndrome. Another is, I believe, I'm not sure about the other two, but I know that they have a variety of diagnoses. So he, and then they've got multiple things that go along with those diagnoses too. So he is the it's a medical house because there are these, like the group home sort of model is so different from the institutionalization model, which is a good thing. And some of the group homes in New Jersey are medical homes because the people need medical care rather than just like behavioral supervision. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he, well, that's the home that he runs, and it's neat. And he takes them on adventures, and they go, you know, they go shopping and they go to the laundromat and they go visit the doctor, and they're coming to, I'm doing a book reading, in New Jersey on April 17th at Clinton Bookshop in Clinton, New Jersey, for my new book, Great. And my brother was like, yo, can I bring them? Because he's so funny, because he's also very much like, yo, girl, how you doing sometimes? Like, I'm making him sound like an idiot, but he's not. He's so smart.
You know, he sounds amazing.
He's like an amazing dude. He's like super good looking. And like, girls are just like, ah. Like, growing up, all my girlfriends were like, he's 3 years younger, but my girlfriends would like give him the eye. And I was like, ugh. So gross.
You're like, that's my brother. Gross. Like,
that's my brother. You're disgusting.
So you had a lot of emotions.
I had all the feelings at once. And so, and yeah. I was a very kind of type A, I have to be perfect, oldest child. And then would beat myself up for falling short of perfection. And started having panic attacks when I was about 10, and it was diagnosed when I was 16.
Oh, that's a long 6 years.
Yeah, and they increased in frequency over the years. So it was, at first when I was 10, I would think, I thought of it as travel sickness, because whenever I would travel, I would have a panic attack. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought I was getting super sick, and that I needed like Dramamine, or that I needed like a Tylenol, or that I needed drink ginger ale.
How did you feel it? What would happen?
Just, it was like the fight or flight response, so a lot of quick heartbeat, nausea, sweating, a sudden feeling of like of fear coming from seemingly out of nowhere.
Right.
So I started to associate it with being away from home. And that is what grew into agoraphobia over the years.
Right.
And that really didn't reach, the agoraphobia really reached its full bloom when I was 21 and I was at Emerson College in Boston. And that's really when it got, in 2001, when it got so bad that I wasn't leaving my bedroom even, in my little apartment, my little studio.
Well, your book, Agoraphabulous, that if you haven't read it, people, read alongside. Go buy it on Amazon Kindle.
Get on the bus. Yeah.
And you can listen to it while you listen. That's not a good plan. You can
You know what?
I
don't actually have, we don't have a
audiobook. Oh, that's not what I mean.
Audiobook.
I mean, read it. I know.
I wish I did. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes. Have you ever
done one?
No, I did it for my Kindle single because, and you know what I learned? That dream of an audiobook will kill the throat. Just doing a Kindle single, a 30-page book, which it's hard work.
Yeah.
But that should be an audiobook.
I would love, that would be so cool to do an audiobook. I would love that.
So, but that, you know, for people who haven't read that, so basically it started with, okay, I'm getting a panic attack when I go away from school, and then it moved into when I go to class.
Sure. It started with specific things like, I get panic attacks when I go on this form of transportation. So when I was, 16, I started taking medication, but it wasn't the right medication for me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that I was misdiagnosed. It was just that, you know, Paxil didn't work very well for me. And
I took that one too.
I didn't recognize, because I was a kid, or really if anybody who's not like a super educated health consumer might not know that there are other options out there. So in my head as a teenager, I was just like, okay, these are the pills that you take when you have this thing. And if I don't respond well to them, that means I'm crazy.
Right.
So I can't tell anybody I'm still having these panic attacks.
Right.
I just have to like take this pill and eventually it'll start to work. And if it doesn't, it's just like, I was very afraid of being, of you know, those being institutionalized against my will and being kept away from my family and my friends and all those sort of girl interrupted movie kind of tropes.
Right.
That you see.
Right. And that probably came out right around then.
I remember it coming out. And also, I came from a family in which a lot of people had experienced mental illness, and a few had been institutionalized against their will in the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, I had my family too.
So you grow up with that sort of specter, even if it's not real anymore.
And there was a lot less known about medication and anti-anxiety medication, sure, and antidepressants and SSRIs.
That just didn't exist. Some of the options didn't exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of those drugs that they gave housewives for panic in
were
the
super
50s
fun drugs.
Were super fun, super exciting, but there's a reason we can't have them anymore.
Because they're not good for us.
We don't have nice things like that anymore.
Right.
Because they're really bad for us. And they would just dope you up and knock you out, which is fun, but, you know,
not conducive to a happy life,
exactly,
ultimately.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but the reason I never drank until I was, I think until I was 23 was because of meds. And I still don't drink very much at all because it's just not a good choice with medication.
Well, they tell you when they give them to you not to drink. Mm-hmm. I totally ignored that. And I always said Paxil didn't work, but I never really gave it a chance. You know,
yeah.
I think that the way I would do it is I would drink. And if I didn't get sick, I'm like, I guess that warning was unnecessary. You know,
yeah, just like, woo, black box warning from the FDA. No problem.
Whatever. And so then you were in a dorm. I can't actually remember.
It was a studio apartment, mm-hmm, in Boston on Newbury Street, which, mm-hmm, is the Rodeo Drive of Boston, Massachusetts.
Which you could not enjoy that time in your life.
Not. And so it was this shitty, really shitty, expensive studio apartment. And it had like a little airplane bathroom, basically, with a shower and no bathtub. And not that that's like such suffering or something, but it was very small. Like, it was hard to close the door when you were sitting on the toilet because your knees were right there. And it didn't have, it had a mini fridge and a hot plate, but it didn't have like a kitchen. And it had a bed that came with the place, which is disgusting. It was a single bed that came with the place.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, okay, this is normal. Like, this is the way things go.
Well, 18, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, okay. And so it was sort of a depressing place to be anyway. And I just got worse and worse, particularly, like, it sounds cliche, but after September 11th, there was this sort of initial moment of weird relief, which sounds really fucked up, but it was like suddenly the outside world, everybody was as scared as I was on the inside. So I felt super normal for a little while, especially when, like, you know, they canceled classes and people weren't going to work for a few days.
Right.
And it was this whole thing. And I remember being like, feeling this weird sense of like, oh, okay. So it was like this confirmation.
Like, you were right to be worried.
I was right to be scared all the time. Okay. And now everybody else gets it too. And then, of course, as life returns slowly to something resembling normalcy, even as it's in the news every day and people are mourning and it's really sad, I was like, oh, wait, no, it is. Nope. There's something wrong with me probably. But I didn't want to deal with it. So I just like kind of stopped eating, stopped really taking care of myself at all. And eventually was pretty confined to my bedroom.
So you stopped going to class.
Stopped going to class.
And your friends and teachers said,
they'd started checking in and being like, where are you? What's going on? And I made up lots of very creative excuses for why I couldn't be there. And at first I like did the work and emailed it in or whatever. But, you know, then I sort of dropped that. And it really, the bad period, I would say, started probably in August of 2001 and, mm-hmm, really came to a head in November, December. And, mm-hmm, then I went home in December. My mom came and picked me up early. And then I tried again in January to go back, new apartment. My parents were kind of like, let's throw money at this. That'll make it better.
Right.
And I thought that too. Because I thought, oh, well, if I'm in really luxurious surroundings that my family can't really afford, obviously I will be happy, right?
Right.
So, and it's so much easier to blame your emotional difficulties, your mental difficulties on the surroundings than to look inside yourself and get some help.
Well, every geographic is based on that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So you get into this nicer place.
Really fancy place at this place called Tremont on the Green, which was very fancy.
Yeah.
And it had a doorman and it had, you know, and it had... it had staff and there was a pool and, I mean, this was fancy pantsy.
Right.
And, it was right on the, not the public garden, the Boston Common, but it was right on Boston Common. super convenient to school, like elevator. It was just very elegant. It was a one bed with a walk-in closet.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, this is amazing, which was great for about a week. And then all the stuff was still there, you know, and I was doing weird stuff. And, you know, finally my friend, I didn't remember this actually. I didn't remember this part, but my friends told me about it within the past couple of years, when the book came out. I remember my friend being like, man, I remember when you called me up that day and told me you were thinking about hurting yourself. And I was like, I did that? Really? And my friend Catherine was like, yeah. And then I called Alexandra, who's my other best friend. I called Alex, and we decided I should call your parents. So then I called your parents, and then your parents called you and came and got you, which was a repeat of what they had done just a month or two earlier. Like, I had spoken to my friend Alexandra. She called my friend Catherine. They were like, this girl cray, what are we going to do? So
right.
Catherine knew my parents a little better, so she called my parents up. And then my parents called me just like, hey, what's up? Kind of out of the blue, like, how you doing? I was like, I'm fine. And they were like, really? And I was like, no. That's like a shortened version of a 30-minute right. conversation.
Right.
By which point I finally admitted I felt sick and maybe needed to go home to rest for a weekend. And but I forgot that it happened again.
Do you now remember those as two separate incidents?
I remember my parents, the first time I went home in December of 2001, my parents did not tell me that my friends had called them up because they didn't want to disrupt my feelings of having a support system. They didn't want me to feel betrayed or embarrassed. Right. They didn't tell me for a couple of years, and I'm really glad they didn't. It was like nice of them not to. The second time, I must have known, because it wasn't, because the way Catherine said it to me was like, oh yeah, I remember I called your mom and she came up and I helped you leave, and it's just not there.
Right.
Like, there's flashes of that apartment. I can picture certain things in it. But it's just not there. Like, remembering her bringing my mom into the room or whatever specific happened. Like, I don't remember it.
Right.
Genuinely don't remember it. It's very, I can invent it in my head what it was probably like.
Right, right.
But I really don't remember it. And so when the book came out in 2012, Agora Fabulous, she was like bringing it up to me. And I was like, wow, I don't remember that interaction. You know, I remember having a panic attack when we went to see the Mandy Moore film, A Walk to Remember.
I remember that film.
I had a panic attack and left. I was like, this is bullshit.
You're like, there's nothing panic inducing about Mandy Moore.
She's so soothing. Yeah, so there are gaps in my memory for sure.
And then what is the right drug? What is the drug that you're on that works?
So I take Prozac. Mm-hmm. I take 60 milligrams a day right now. Mm-hmm. And I take Abilify. Mm-hmm. So Prozac, as I'm sure you know, is an SSRI. Mm-hmm. But not everybody knows that, thankfully, because not everyone needs to know that.
Yeah.
Abilify is what's called an atypical antipsychotic. So it's like a second generation antipsychotic. And it's used generally at higher doses. It's used for people with bipolar. I'm not sure about the difference between bipolar 1 and 2 and all that stuff.
I know about it. Ooh. I just found out.
Oh, I don't know anything about it. Well, no, that's not true. I do know about it because I've had friends who've gone through the depressions and then the manics.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know as far as like treating it with meds. You know, I'm not really sure how it works. I just know that my psychiatrist told me that at higher doses, Abilify is used for bipolar and then for like higher doses than that for schizophrenia.
Oh, interesting.
But at a low dose, I guess what they found at this certain low dose was that it wasn't really helping people who were bipolar or schizophrenic, but it was serving as like a, I call it like a wheatgrass booster,
right,
to an SSRI.
Yeah, that's what I've always heard of. So bipolar 2 is not I'm no doctor. This came right, from a doctor though. So, but from what I understand, bipolar 1 is the bipolar we hear about,
you manic know, the depressive, highs
and
lows. Yeah.
And bipolar 2 is more like a very high level of irritation.
Oh.
Not all this manic, you know, just more depression and, you know, irritation.
Oh, wow.
Which
that's so interesting.
I find fascinating. But yeah, no, I had heard of Abilify as like the wheatgrass. Like basically if your antidepressant stops working, throw some Abilify at it.
Which they call the Prozac poop out for Prozac. That's right. Like actually what it's called.
Is that why Abilify came into your life?
Abilify came into my life in 2011. I got I had been dating someone who got deployed to Afghanistan.
I know about
this. Right, I told you about this. I told you about that. You did meet him. He came to the reading with his girlfriend who lives near me and my boyfriend now, which is really funny. So he and his girlfriend came, who's a friend of mine, came to the reading at the last bookstore, which was really cool.
God, that picture of you from there is so amazing. It makes me want to go back there.
It was so fun.
I was too busy stressing to go and have all that fun you were having.
You had to organize everything, and that's like why producing a show is
the worst thing.
People don't get why
it
sucks.
Yeah.
You know, it can be fun when you have great show, you're like, this is the best, but it sucks when it sucks.
Well, it's like, it's sort of like writing sometimes. I'm glad to have done it.
Yep.
Don't know if I'm glad. I was glad I was doing it.
I read some quote the other day as an aside where someone had said, you know, nothing like publishing has its pleasures, but there's nothing like being in the midst of writing. And I was like, and I like to retweet it and wrote lie. It wasn't the woman who said it hadn't tweeted it. Someone else had tweeted like advice to writers had tweeted it. And I was like, lie. Because I was like, no, having published is awesome. But the actual writing is like, ah. I understood what she meant. But anyway, so I was dating this guy, Benari, and he got deployed to Afghanistan. And at that point I was dealing with not just like him being gone, but the fact that I hadn't dealt with the fallout from my previous relationship, who I live with now,
who's a previous podcast guest,
Mr. John DeVore. And so because I had not dealt with a breakup and then I had another one basically, it just opened up this. It was like I had been using love
to medicate this issue. Yeah.
And I didn't take a break. I wasn't like, oh, hey, this one very important relationship to me is breaking up. Let me deal with this. I was like, nope, I'm just going to start up with somebody else right away.
Look, plenty of people seem to do it all the time.
Absolutely.
Look at any celebrity.
Oh, absolutely. Because being alone is scary and sad and those feelings hurt. And you want to not have those feelings anymore. And so what better way than just to segue into being with somebody else?
Right.
And of course, that ultimately does a disservice to yourself, the other person, everybody. It, you know, cheapens what you had, all this other stuff, you know, but it's like an anesthesia that you're just applying. Now, I don't want to demean my relationship with him, Benari, who's great. He's on Twitter at Benari Lee, to say that that's all it was.
Right.
But I think one of the reasons we can be friends today and that I can talk about this without going into like super detail is just that I think we sort of, I think we've figured out kind of what that was and how that fit. And, you know, I mean, he's an awesome person, and I'm so happy that he's with like the fucking coolest girl.
Did you set him up with her?
No. They got together, and they had known each other previously, and they got together, and I remember having this feeling they were going to get together and just being like, that's good, like that's supposed to happen.
So
I think I was a speed bump on the way in some way. Maybe that's just me trying to make it sound good in my narrative, but like they're cool people. She writes like video games and stuff.
Oh wow.
Yeah, they just got a min pin, like miniature pincher.
Oh wow.
She's just a cool girl. Yeah. Like surfs.
Yeah.
She's always trying to get me to surf and I'm like, ugh.
See, I wanted to be the surfer girl, and now in retrospect, I wish that I was the nerd girl. All like just that these girls, they can play video games in this
office.
That's
cool.
They
she's
make
both.
Apps.
Yeah, I she's know. The video she designs the video games, and then she's on Twitter at Stacey Garrett. That's StaceyGarrett. Yeah, I really like the E.
Yeah.
I think that's really neat. So she's just fucking cool and very funny. And, you know, so they're just such a neat, interesting, you got this like veteran of three, you know, fronts in three, you know, he's been to Guantanamo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. You got him, and plus he's a comedian, plus he's a an adjunct professor of screenwriting at Cal State Fullerton, I think. Then you got this chick who's like, she writes video games. She's got a
together
min pin.
Together they can take over the world.
Seriously, they have so many skills between them. It's so weird.
They need to procreate and create an army.
They're going to create the most, like, it's basically going to be their own, like, Israeli army. That's going to take over everything.
Oh my God, I'm so glad I know about them before this happened.
Yeah, they're very cool. Just get on their side before, like, any of that. I mean, I don't know if it'll happen, but I hope it does, because those children will take over the world. So they're very neat, but and obviously they're cool because they fucking came to see me read a story.
Yeah.
Which is really nice.
About an affair with a different guy.
Affair with a different guy. And so 2011, so he leaves. I'm like, oh, now I have to deal with that. A lot of, you know, sadness, worry, concern.
And you're in New York City, which is a difficult place to live.
It's a panicky place. Yeah. It's a difficult place to live. I'm, you know, missing this person who I loved very deeply, Mr. John DeVore, who I continue to love very deeply. And suddenly dealing with that, like, oh, wow, okay. You know, like he told his own story. You should listen to his episode of the podcast.
I know. I wish the sound equipment was better on that one, because he's such a delight.
He's great.
And the sound quality was not great.
But you know, I haven't even, have I listened to part of it?
He's so funny and so good on it.
Did he talk about, like, did you guys talk about, like, sobriety and stuff like that?
Yeah, pretty much the whole time.
Okay. So, you know, he, like, did the work.
Yeah.
I didn't do the work. And so there I was, you know, it's 2011.
And we talked about you, because you were the one that said to him,
I said, I think you have a problem. Drunk. Yeah. And he was really, it was interesting because he said no one had said that to him before.
Which is crazy, because I knew him in New York and we all knew he was a drunk.
Right. So it's interesting. And it's such a charming.
Yeah.
Just so charming. All the people who have any issues that I know with addiction, yourself included, are so charming. Like, God, it just comes with you. There's something very sexy and charming about those people.
There are plenty who are not, by the way.
I'm sure there are.
But no, I would say that that's absolutely true. Some of the most charming people I know.
Smartest, most interesting, creative people I know. And it's not, and this remains true when they get sober. I've noticed this too. It doesn't go away.
Well, it becomes more true in many people's cases.
Well, what I've seen is that, you know, I look at John and I see how his career has taken off in ways that I think are from my perspective, and I'm super biased, but because I live with him.
Yeah.
But I have seen how his career has taken off over the past few years, and how things have changed, and just, you know, I don't know if he would agree or disagree with me on this, but he writes so beautifully in reflecting on those times.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
It's just great. And he just, you know, he moved out here to California. He's doing all cool stuff. And anyway, it was a big loss to not have that relationship anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, that being said, you know, I lost it in New York, in Queens, where I lived, and just crying all the time uncontrollably. What do I do about this? And I sat down with my boss at a site called Bookish. He's not there anymore. I'm not there anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. I think they just sold it.
It's a great name. I've never heard
Bookish.
Of it.
It's a really cute name. It was this publishing site. And I would go in and just freelance writing about different books and stuff. And it was like, it was one of those sites that, you know, you just wait for it to launch for like a year or 2 years, and then it finally does.
Yeah.
So Charlie, who's a great writer, was an editor, was my editor at the time. And I went in and sat down with him in the conference room, and I just said, started crying. I was like, I think I need to take time off or work from home. Like, something's not right. I'm not okay. And he was like, we did not have such a close relationship that was necessarily a normal thing for me to do.
Right.
But he opened up right away and talked to me about people he'd known and stuff he'd been through, and was just like, Sarah, take time off. Like, it was amazing. There was no pressure. He was like, take time off. You're freelance for a reason. You get to make your own hours. You get to decide how much work you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather have you, he said something to me to the effect of, I would rather have you healthy and turning in a piece every few months,
right,
then be churning stuff out every day and be miserable. Right. So I went home for 2 months. I gave up my apartment, went home for a couple months, and it almost felt like a repeat. It was 10 years later, almost to the month. You know, it was 10 years later, and there I was. And I talked to John a lot during that time. And he was very concerned about me, but never really let me know that he was super worried until after I was better. Like, he really had it together to provide a lot of emotional support. I mean, to his fucking ex-girlfriend calling him up crying about how she misses so-and-so who's off in fucking Afghanistan. Like,
what a guy.
You know, I mean, what a good dude. And And also just, I was just so depressed, and he really was there for me like 110%.
Well, and so it was a repeat of a decade earlier, but it mm-hmm. was depression instead of panic.
It was depression. It was pretty, really heavy, heavy depression. And yeah. that is when I went on Abilify. I went from like 40 milligrams of Prozac to 60 mm-hmm. and threw in some Abilify mm-hmm. and it was like banging.
She was back.
I was like, I'm back. And then I moved back to Queens and, you know, resumed working at Bookish and writing. That's when my book was due. My agent, Scott Mendel, who's a great dude, was very helpful during that time because my book was due and I was bottoming out, depressed. And that right. was part of it too. Well, you know this, writing about like sad stuff that yeah. you've done or that's yeah. happened to you, that, I mean,
it definitely, you are in it. Mm-hmm. I went through that with my memoir where it was a depression that lasts for, because you're, it's like if they know that in terms of like, you know, ways to combat depression, don't focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
Think of other people. All of those things you cannot do if you're writing a memoir about it.
It was like I relived it in miniature.
Yeah.
And my editor at William Marr, her name is Cassie Jones. She's fucking awesome. She was really great too.
I think her husband was my editor.
Cal?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, for years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So she was really great. And you know, one good thing about it was that, and one good thing that I think is probably true for you too, I'm making an assumption here, but is that because a lot of our shit is out there, not yeah. all of it, but yeah. a lot of it's out there, editors and people like that kind of know what they're going to get. So they're, it's not like what I'm saying is they still expect us to make deadlines and do our work.
Right.
But if we are depressed or if we are like, I have to go to a meeting or if we are like, whatever, they're not going to be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What? This is crazy.
It depends on the person.
You're right. That's true. It also, because I can see somebody who's, because you work in so many capacities and write about so much stuff that I could see somebody.
People are like, which issue am I, which part of yeah,
and that if you're,
with?
You know, writing about, is that something new, sugar daddies, shopping for sugar daddies?
Yes.
That's so fun.
Yeah. I wrote about that for Marie Claire UK.
So fun.
Yeah. That became an accidental beat of mine. Somebody, you know, asked me to do something for a men's site and then I did it. And then this Marie Claire thing came up and now there is talk, very, not even quotation around talk, very low level talk about making it into a reality show. We'll see.
That's really cool.
Yeah. It was like this crazy thing. But the truth is I don't want to be writing about sex, dating, relationships. It's not interesting it's interesting. I became an accidental person who did that.
Yes.
And then when I realized that I could do that, I was like, well, wait a minute. Could I change the conversation and focus so that I can talk about something that I think needs attention, like addiction and recovery? But I can't. It's like that, you know, hole I can't climb out of because, you know, I still don't turn down work. That's
oh, sure,
about
we
it,
do. When people know? Are like, come here and talk about sex and love, I'm like, cool, man. Awesome. Like, I'll ride this out until you've decided that I'm not okay to do it anymore.
Right. It's really hard to say no to jobs.
Well,
basically.
Yeah. And it's getting easier to say no to things that do not pay.
Yeah.
I will say that.
Yeah.
But then there are things not, there are also some things that do not pay that are so amazing with exposure that you're just like, of course I'm going to fucking do this.
Well, I mean, it's interesting.
Like TV appearances and shit like
that. See, the TV stuff, I get, my thing is if it's not about addiction, I'm not going to do it. But then I say that and then I went on the talk and talked about, you know, so there are exceptions, but
oh, sure.
It's really hard, you know, and it's really hard to have boundaries around that because they will stop calling you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I get their position as a booker. They just want someone who's going to say yes and show up and do a good job.
They're sitting at their desk.
Yeah. Making a bunch of calls.
Yeah. Just like churning it out. It's not, that's another thing to, that's good to see that why it's good that you produced a show and why I've produced a show because we get to see the other side of it.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was saying about you is it gave me great perspective because why not be that person that someone will come away. I talked to my therapist about you.
Oh, that's so great.
This.
I feel
yeah,
so
that someone comes away and says, that person's a delight to deal with. I want to deal with her again.
Yeah.
Because that's rare.
And I have so much fun with you and you have given me a platform to, I mean, who doesn't love talking about themselves?
Yeah.
Someone was saying, I have a writer's group and last night we were talking about how to be when you go into a meeting for staffing. And someone was like, just ask them questions. People love to be asked questions.
So true.
And I was like, it's true. It's really true.
I know.
It's super true.
What's your little writer's group? Why am I suddenly like wanting to know more?
Oh, it's really fun. It's a writer's group that
I'm feeling left out.
A friend, a friend. Well, most of the people who don't write books, I think I'm the only person who writes like books and freelancing and stuff.
Yeah.
They all write like
TV,
TV and movies and stuff like that.
I want to be even in even more.
And so they're neat people. And so I just kind of ask a lot of questions, but we meet every other Monday and we just kind of hang out for 3 hours and share different things. And so sometimes it's a little, I bring in stuff that's a little different because I'm like, I recently was pitching a fourth book and I brought in some ideas to them and they're not, and it was good because they don't come from a publishing background. Right. So it was neat to be able to see what they thought.
Do you get jealous though, that the, how much more money they're making?
Not jealous, but like, I get wistful. Mm-hmm. You know, I do get jealous sometimes of people, but usually it has to do with like love or romance, you know, or like it's rare that I get jealous of somebody for like having a hotter, like a thinner body or having more money, but I get wistful about that.
Interesting.
The jealousy is possessive.
Yeah.
But I do get jealous when it comes to relationships, like with men. I get very like, and I've worked on it for years, but that is like a, I can't blame that on any kind of mental illness. That is just like a character flaw that I'm working on.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the reasons I started that show is my jealousy of other women's success was so great.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Because that doesn't, I don't read that on you at all.
It cured me.
That's awesome.
Because every month, other women who had things I, you know, you had to be kind of impressive. So you had things I wanted. Everyone's success kind of became my success, and it sort of melded this brain chemistry that saw that us as separate.
We're That's all the really
same,
cool.
You know?
That's really cool.
And so it's like now I see someone getting something as like, it's almost like I got it. I mean, it's not quite that, but it's like any success should be celebrated, especially in book publishing where the pain is great and the triumphs are short.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I mean, it also, I like that saying, what is it? A rising tide lifts all ships or something like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really buy into that for a long time, but then I started applying it in my own life and I started seeing how once in a while somebody else would apply it to me too. And like a girl I met, got me a job, just a job that I got paid a couple $100 for that was just writing some funny jokes. And I just met her casually and we just had a nice interaction and she thought of me because she couldn't do the job.
Right.
And that kind of thing happens, I think, more the more you can't, there's a balance because you can't like wear yourself out trying to do stuff for other people all the time. But I think the more you sort of delicately try and put little opportunities out there for other people when you can, the more that kind of starts to happen for you too.
I totally agree with that. I totally do.
John talks about how this, how New York is a favor-based economy and LA is more like a mafia. Like it's who you know and who your buddies are. But I think there's a bit of both in both cities, honestly.
I think that he and I on the podcast got into a fight about LA versus New York, which I will take anyone down on that.
I love LA. I think it's great.
It's so great.
It's great. He's like, he's such a grumpy man.
Right.
But he, like, I love it. You know, the other day he wrote this on Twitter. He said, we were eating, he put it on Twitter, so I feel like I'm allowed to say it. We were eating at some, at a French restaurant in a strip mall in Burbank, right? Mm-hmm. And we were talking and kind of like, he was like, started to bait me because he likes to do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. It like amuses him. And so he said something to the effect of, I just never saw the appeal of the comforts of the bourgeoisie. And I started laughing so hard because it was such a John thing to say. It like, it was so ridiculous. And I knew he was saying it just to fuck with me. And I started laughing so hard. And like, then he put it on Twitter because it was like such a dumb thing to say. He was like, I have to put this on Twitter.
Yeah.
This is so ridiculous. But then sometimes he'll relent and he'll go, you know what? I do like that. He loves The Last Bookstore. I got him that gift certificate when I was there
when we
were signing. And he has since been there twice. He hasn't even used a gift certificate yet. He just goes and he loves it. Like LA has some cool shit.
Yeah, it does take New Yorkers. They've got this idea and it just takes, you know, to get them over the hump.
Their identity is so wrapped up in that city that It's almost like someone whose identity is really wrapped up in the word victim.
So
they're just like, and you say to that person, like, sure, you are perhaps you are a victim. And I also look at you as a survivor. And they're like, what?
Right.
It's like, yes, you are a New Yorker, but could you not also be
it's like improv.
A Detroiter?
Yes, and.
Or yes, and an Angelino, or perhaps a San Franciscan. And they're like, sure, fuck this. And then they start to like things like being able to afford an avocado.
Right. Or being able to not be too cold or too hot at all times.
Yeah. I mean, I love New York, and New York's a great place to be if you have a shitload of money.
Yeah.
Great place to be.
I think we're young and drunk.
Young and drunk. Yeah, I was that. Mm-hmm. I was that for sure. But I mean, for my girlfriends who are like, I don't know why I'm not meeting men. It's like, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're wonderful. New York City just doesn't, the numbers just aren't there.
I would say New York is much better for that than LA.
Really? Because I haven't dated here, so I don't know. My girlfriends do say that here, they say it's weird dating, but they never tell me what is weird about it.
My thing was, you know, I've been primarily single as I work out my issues, but I would, in New York, I was always dating somebody, which is never really true here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that was that I was so unhappy all the time that I was willing to date people that I would never be willing to date here.
That may be part of it.
It's really easy to be kind of very content here, no matter what's going on in your life. You know, it's sunny, it's not that expensive, whatever. I don't know.
That might be it, though. And the frenetic New York has this frenetic need to keep you busy all the time. And that works great for me because it is how I avoid dealing with my feelings in life. So that's great. But then sometimes it's good to have a feeling from its beginning to its completion and deal with it emotionally and stuff.
I'm learning how to do that now.
Yeah, I still am learning.
It's very weird.
Oh, just the other day, John was like, you're not in regular therapy. So don't you think that's a good idea for you? And he, not in a condescending way, I made it sound that way, but he was just basically like, don't you think it's a good idea? And I was like, oh, yeah, that is a really, I should be in regular therapy. Like, it's been
how
a few months.
How long has it been? Oh.
It's been a few months.
So you have someone out here.
I have someone out here who I like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's time to go back to her or maybe try someone new using my health insurance that I have now.
I have the most amazing therapist. She didn't take insurance, but she is spectacular.
That's awesome.
And she knows about you.
Oh, yeah. I'll be like, hello. I'll just appear and be like, hello.
Hello, I know I'm perfect.
There's this woman in New York who was fabulous, and she had all these stand-up comedians, mm-hmm. women stand-up comedians, mm-hmm. as clients, because we all referred each other to her.
Mm-hmm.
So she would know who we were talking about, but she was very good. We all would check in, and she was very good about not telling us each other's secrets.
Well, this one, I was referred to her, and then my friend, I have a friend, mm-hmm. I guess I shouldn't say her name.
Yeah, I was just thinking that about my friend. I was like, I won't say her name.
Because she was like, oh, therapy in Larchmont, is it? And so she randomly got to her, and then she said, all the smart women in LA go to her. And then she told me like four other people. And so suddenly I was like, oh, she's cool.
It's like this inside club. And when you go to the waiting room, you're like, who will I see?
I know. I had a great celebrity signing at my last two therapists ago.
One time at my therapist, because I did go to, I went to a social worker in high school after I got like diagnosed for anxiety and depression and stuff. I saw a girl who was a cheerleader, and it felt like a celebrity
That's
sighting.
Not true.
I saw her, and I was like, you have problems too.
Isn't that weird? I do remember there was in college, there was this awesome psychology professor who was also a therapist. And so I went to him. I'd been in therapy since I was 16. And I remember leaving and seeing this friend of mine, this guy, and he was so embarrassed.
Oh, especially for dudes, because that's so, for a boy at that age, in adolescence, post-adolescence, whatever, like that's for a guy to admit, you know. I mean, I know a lot of guys who are very cool and are very like, yeah, I just go and I work out my issues. But a lot of dudes are like, fuck no.
I don't even understand. Yeah. When I moved back here from New York, I was like, I don't think I need that therapy thing. And then within 6 months, I'm like, oh, no. This is a really, really, really good idea.
Yeah, I'm like, I need to go back to Julie. I'm probably going to text her, email her today, and just be like, hello, can I come see
you? It's not Julie M, is it?
No. It's Julie F.
I got excited.
But I'm not, like in crisis or anything right now.
But that's just a good time to go.
That's a good time to go rather than going when you're losing your shit completely, and then they have to help you dig out.
Untangle. You're like the telephone. Remember the old telephone cords? Mm-hmm. You know, they can tangle, and then you're just suddenly like exploding.
You're like, ah. So yeah.
So therefore it works. Like, you are a happy medication story, really, because you're not doing other therapy. But are there things you learn in therapy that you use to deal with the mental illness?
Yes, absolutely. And things I've learned from specifically reading Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn when I was younger.
I don't know that.
It's a great one. It has to do with, he runs El Presidente and founder of the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical School at Worcester. Mm-hmm. So it's a University of Massachusetts outfit. I believe it's called the Center for Mindfulness. They do MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is an 8-week program that incorporates
meditation,
yoga, and it's not anti-medication at all. It was founded by Jon Kabat-Zinn and Dr. Saki Santarelli, who's a cardiologist, and they have been in business for I think 30 years now. And it has, they run this 8-week course. You meet once a week for 8 weeks, and they have them out here. They have them all over the place. And they do them for like firefighters in Worcester and like, you know, people, I mean, all kinds of folks and just people like me. And so I got into that when I was, right when I had that breakdown, I read that book and went to a psychiatrist regularly who had seen two other generations in my family. And so I started seeing it. So it was like he was cheating because he had the whole family history. But that, yeah.
Did you go to their 8-week?
I did not. I went to a couple. When I went back to Boston, I tried to go back, and I made it through like 3 weeks, and then I left. But that it was actually a good thing, because going to those 3 weeks was so helpful, and I got the binder and everything, and I continued the work at home. So I continued doing it on my own for the next 5 weeks.
And it's for anxiety.
Any kind of pain management, any kind of stress. So we had people, in my group who were dealing with, who were recovering from cancer. A woman whose stepchildren had just died in a car crash. Oh, okay. Someone with HIV/AIDS, other people with panic attacks, bipolar, depression. I mean, you know, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, like all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And it's great. It teaches you, probably a lot of the stuff would be familiar to you anyway, because it's like just basic mindfulness techniques. But it's awesome.
Yeah, and to spend an hour every day, every week, sort of concentrating on it.
And you do your homework. So every day you have basically like a 45-minute assignment to do, which is maybe a meditation combined with stretching or like a visualization exercise. And it's awesome. And it's so like low pressure. They're just like, yeah, it'd be great if you could do this for 45 minutes, but if you can do it for 5, that's cool too.
Right. Realistic. So would you say that your depression is like in remission, or do you still deal with it?
I still deal with it. Mm-hmm. I would say it's not. Do you get, at the end of a big project, do you get a letdown feeling?
Depends. It depends. Like with the storytelling show, I was just relieved.
Like, thank God. Yeah.
But oftentimes with books, it's not the turning in so much as the thing you're starting right now, the release. You know, I have a friend, mm-hmm. Richard Rushfield, who always says, oh, I feel so sorry for people when their books come out. Like, everybody else is going, congratulations, it's so exciting. But it brings out every insecurity, every feeling of unworthiness, every feeling of it's not fair.
I Google my name every day to read reviews. Like, see, but every
I feel
day.
Like your sensibility is so positive. And even like when you send out a thing about it, I don't know. It doesn't seem like that would take you down the way it takes some of us down.
It once in a while does. It's not, I think stand-up comedy has been really helpful because having that stand-up background with people, sometimes just texting while you're telling this joke about your life or you know, I don't think I've ever had booze, but I've certainly had people who are just like, or we call it walking the room when like somebody walks out. That was really helpful. Doing a bunch of, like, I did a bunch of YouTube videos where I was Sarah Palin in 2008 for Huffington Post and, you know, getting called like a you know, all kinds of like racial epithets and crazy
stuff. What racial epithet are they giving you?
There were people who would drop N-bombs, which was really weird because I was like, where is that coming from? Like, that's really, not only is that a deeply offensive and horrible, it's also really misplaced. But, you know, it's definitely like calling me a cunt and like all kinds of stuff like that. And so once you've had those people chase you, like the really angry people, it's not that the reviews still matter to me, but it's not as bad. But once in a while, if it gets me on a bad day, or if it's like somebody whose viewpoint I think I share, and they're like, I remember one woman read my new book Great and was like, because it's not out yet, but she had like an advanced reading copy,
right?
She was like, ugh, it's so, you know, it's so body shaming and it's this and that, all this stuff I did not intend.
Right.
It's a book about, you know, it's
lesbian
teens. It's inspired by The Great Gatsby, but with girls in the Hamptons set in 2014. And there's a lot of superficiality. And that's one of the big things that we play with in the book, obviously, is the superficial versus the real. And so there is some focus on appearance. And this person took the fictional narrator's point of view to be my point
of
view.
Which they always will.
Which I've never written fiction before.
Oh, yeah. And they will say, you know, she said, Bed in Casa Fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And I was, this was one of those first early reviews, and I was just like, what? Like this person, but I'm an ally, and this person thinks that I'm like, you know, I'm homophobic or something, or what? I'm so confused. And so that gets me when I think I'm like, but I'm on their side, you know, I'm your...
Does it make you angry and upset?
Sometimes, yeah.
There was this... It's funny because I was reading the reviews for this podcast, of which there were many more, and that there were a few that are really nice. And then there was this one that was just like, this podcast gets amazing guests. It's too bad that the host, Anna David, has what my mother would call an unfortunate personality. Not that I've memorized every word of it. And so one of the comforts of those people who really always trash you on Amazon is that you then go click on their name and they've gone and trashed everything and then they love a Justin Bieber album or whatever and you go, oh, okay.
And you're like, I get it.
It's fine. I'm fine not having you. And I looked and she had given all these other podcasts a rave review. And I'm just like, wow, it really is about
me. She was like, what the fuck with Marc Maron is brilliant. But Anna David talks
about herself
too much.
And they were addiction and recovery podcasts. I was like, oh man. But, you know, and that one really, that hurt, you know. But most of the time, I mean, I agree, the like vitriol and the ones where it's so clear that it doesn't have to do with you just gives you a sort of tougher skin.
It's, I think so. And it's also, there've been a couple times when you're not like supposed to do this, but there've been a couple times when I read negative reviews that were really smart, that were good, that I actually have, it's happened twice, I think, that I'd actually reached out to the person who wrote it and just been like, hey man, I know you didn't like the book or you didn't like these aspects of it, but you're writing, there's a girl online on Goodreads actually who I reached out to and I was like, I didn't even say I'm sorry you didn't like the book, because I'm not sorry.
No.
I like the book. Yeah. I was just like, she had some critical comments about my novel. I'd never written fiction before. First novel that I took with me that helped me write my second book.
Interesting.
And I told her that. I was like, you helped me. And she was like, oh my gosh, I hope I didn't insult you. Because, you know, when you push back, they're like, oh, they either get really fighty or they're like, oh. But I wasn't insulting her. I was saying thank you. And I was like, no. Like, you really thought about this. Like, you took something I spent a lot of my life on and you really thought about it. And you didn't say, like, this girl's a stupid bitch. You said, I don't like the way this character speaks and acts, and I think it didn't ring true to me, and here's why. I was like, it was really smart, and it actually helped me. No, I'm not going to do that for everybody.
I might never do that ever again.
Like, I probably never will do that again. But with two people in particular, they helped me see places where I had actually been insensitive where I had missed some stuff.
Right.
Where I had been unconsciously kind of shitty. Where it just artistically wasn't that great. And, you know, because it's not a perfect book.
But that's really big of you and, you know, characteristic of a writer.
Well, it's not something I'm going to make a habit of. Yeah. But I did this time. These two girls both were of assistance because I was like, mm-hmm. But then you get these fucking trolls who are just like, I hate this. And, you know, there was this thing with this author, Kathleen Hale, that happened. She's a YA author. Really funny. I'm sure her book's awesome. Good writer. And she, you know, complained about book bloggers and they to an extent in an interview and she flipped out and she didn't flip out. Yeah. They flipped out. And I understood both sides of the situation very much because I was like, I get it. I get where she's coming from. I get where they're coming from. Like, these are people who just love books so much that it is just such a passion and such a passion to the point where with some people, they don't realize there's a human being behind it.
I think that's a big thing. And also, it's sort of like celebrity coverage back before it was just what it is now, back when, you know, I worked at Premiere, and there's such a huge dichotomy. Well, that's even worse, because the dichotomy between the very smart person writing a lot of this industry news and the person they're covering, there's a lot of jealousy that is unconscious. And I do think book bloggers, many of them wish they could write books.
And want to and are trying, and it's a shitty, hard, it's a shitty industry.
It's like, the worst.
It's really hard. Yeah. It's a really hard
it's
industry.
It's worse than comedy, don't you think?
Yes, I think it is. Yes, absolutely. I think that's interesting. I've never compared them in my head before. I think publishing has more room for women. I'll say that. Mm. Because women are the buyers, mm-hmm. largely are the buyers. But then again, publishing is, I mean, there are people out there writing, like book bloggers writing these beautiful reviews that are so amazing that I'm like, why don't you have a book deal? Maybe that some folks actually don't want it. They're just like, some people are that true critic. And I don't mean a troll. I mean like a true critic, like a Pauline Kael, who just, they're made to just experience art and interpret it and express it. And there's a Roger Ebert, like what a gift he had, man. Right. I like to read, I'll read reviews that he's written of
movies you haven't even seen.
Yeah. That I'm never going to fucking see.
Right.
Because there's a wisdom and a humanity and like a love there. And that's a rare bird. You know, I think it's a lot easier to be like, well, this is dumb.
Yeah.
But a comedy versus publishing, interesting. I wonder which is
crueler.
Crueler, yeah. It's interesting, like, which is crueler to people of color, which is crueler to women, which is crueler to humans in general, which is crueler to, you know, people trying to be, gosh, it's so interesting. I could talk about this for 8 years.
Yeah, no, that is interesting, because I think publishing is across the board cruel. It doesn't matter if you're a woman, a guy, or
there is sort of a universal... And that's sort of endearing about it. Also, people don't realize that a lot of book editors don't make a ton of money.
No, I know. And even agents.
They don't necessarily make a ton of money.
No.
And authors. We don't necessarily make a ton of money. J.K. Rowling is doing fine.
If they listen to this podcast, they know. That, you know, and that's the cruelty. The cruelty is not anything but the money, you know, which is why I don't want to do it anymore. It's like, fuck this.
It's intense.
But you have managed to, your Agora Fabulous is being made into a TV show, right?
Hopefully. It's a pilot right now. It's with USA and it's with the production company is ABC Studios. And then my executive producers are a woman named Debbie Liebling, who is over at Ben Stiller's company, Red Hour. And then Mason Novak and Diablo Cody, who work together, which is great.
Together you wrote the pilot.
No, I wrote the pilot. That's and amazing. They just like they oversaw, like Diablo supervised and Mason and Debbie did too, basically. Like they all, you know, I bounced it off them and they gave their notes. They were super helpful. And so now it's at USA and we're just waiting to hear what they think of it. And you know, it goes through like in your contract you have to go through, I think, 3 drafts, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, just like a book contract that you owe them certain amounts of things. And so it's still pretty new. Like mm-hmm. they've just gotten the draft that we sent them. But I hope they dig it. I mean, it's cool. It's very cool to be doing that. And it's not And it's inspired by the book. It's adapted from the book, but it's not the book. So the main character's name is Sarah, but she's not necessarily me.
Right.
She has a family that's similar to mine, but they're not the same as mine. Right. They don't live in the same place, and her economic background is a little different. And she is, you know, has some different dreams and hopes than I had. And she's also 23 in 2014, which I am not.
Right. But you look it.
Oh, thank you. It's because I stay indoors all the time. Like a hobbit.
What, and so Great, which is pretty much like out.
April 8th, it'll be out, yeah.
And you're going around and talking to people about it. You're going to be in New York?
I'm going to be in New York. I'm doing an event at Books of Wonder on Wednesday, April 16th.
That's a great store.
I'm very excited to do an event there. Right? I've never done an event there. Yeah, it's 18 West 18th Street.
Yes.
And that is Wednesday, April 16th from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. So if you, you know, if somebody's at work, I understand. But come later because my mom is bringing a cake. So you can have cake and cookies.
Yeah.
And then there's an event here in LA at Book Soup.
Oh yeah, it's already on my calendar.
Awesome. That's April 9th at 7 p.m. at Book Soup in West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I did an Agora Fabulous reading there, and it was very exciting because
who was there?
The man. Okay, so he wasn't there for me. But who's the man who plays Dexter?
Michael C. Hall.
Yeah, he was there. And I don't think he bought my book, but he looked at the cover, and I got really excited.
That's almost as cool as the time I parked in front of Book Soup, because I was going to a party sort of across the street, and there was no parking. Mm-hmm. And the dude, as in the guy that The Big Lebowski was based on, was there.
The real dude?
The real dude.
Whoa, cool.
People were freaking the F out.
People, there's like a whole philosophy surrounding that film and like a cult of awareness and belief.
And like festivals and like...
It's really cool.
But my question... And then you also go to colleges and speak to college students about depression and panic attacks.
Yeah,
and
I
that
talk
kind
to
of
them.
Thing.
Basically, I'm there to, in a sometimes entertaining and sometimes poignant fashion, share my story and introduce them to the idea, which some of them are familiar with, some of them are not, that it does not make you a bad or weak person to ask for help.
Right.
And so, because there are 1,100 suicides on college campuses every year. And so that's in the United States. And so that is bad and not good. And so in order to help to make a tiny dent in changing that, I just go out there, I share my story, and it's cool. I like it. It's the most rewarding thing I do. It is pound for pound, minute for minute, the most financially and emotionally rewarding.
I know. I do it too. I wish I could do it all the
time. It's great. I'm just like, oh, that's amazing. And actually, you know who's been on tour a lot? We have the same representation, Laverne Cox from Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
She's always going out. I mean, imagine how inspiring that is to a kid. Oh, my God. Like, just amazing. And, you know, Dan Savage does a lot of colleges. A lot of people do colleges.
Oh, yeah.
I do.
I think a lot of writers, if they can, because
it's fun.
It augments that
absolutely augments
part.
It makes you get to be around people. I get to be around people. I get to travel and see the country.
And you get to see, I get to see the most random towns ever.
Me too.
And sort of get grateful for where I live and all this stuff.
Middle of nowhere, and I hang out, and you know what? And I go to Ruby Tuesday with the kids.
Right.
And I'm just like, what's going on? And they like talk to me. I'm like, what's cool now? I'm old. What's going on? And they're like, oh, let me tell you.
You're like, let me tell you about my affair with a college student.
Got a story in True Tales of Lust and Love available.
Available now on
from
Amazon.
From Soft Skull Press.
Well, you are a total delight.
Oh, thank you so much.
So where can people find you?
So I'm on Twitter constantly.
Yes.
And it's at Sarah J. Benincasa. It's SarahJBenincasa. Or SarahBenincasa.com. Or Facebook.com/official Sarah Benincasa. Or Instagram.com/SarahJBenincasa. You can go to all of those places and we can hang out.
You can know. What you should know is she can't be your Facebook friend. I've tried. She's got all over 5,000.
You know what I did? That account I actually deleted, but it still comes up. I have I have a fan page.
Oh, you sure do.
And then I have a
secret.
I have a little page that runs the fan page, but I don't have any friends. I don't even think John is my friend. I don't have a picture up, nothing.
Speaking of John, a fun thing to do on Twitter is follow John DeVore too, because you can see them experience the same thing and have different reactions to it. It's especially fun during, say, an Oscars.
It's true. We sit next to each other and just talk about the same stuff and like don't look at each other. And then once in a while, we'll look at each other's tweets and laugh and like retweet them. But it's just, we're just both like, Live tweeting the Oscars or some kind of event like that is a great exercise, I find, for joke writing. You see what lands. I mean, that's what Twitter is.
Yeah.
So much. You see what lands with people, and you can then take that and incorporate that into a piece of writing if it's not super, you know, timely.
God, that's so true.
I do that with stuff with, and it works with inspirational stuff too. When you write something, like you see something inspirational gets tweeted a bunch of times, you're like, oh, okay.
Except that it's not an exact science, and no. A lot of it has to do with timing, sure. And if Rob Delaney retweets you, and you mm-hmm. know, all of these other things.
Twitter is like a big, big party. And the super cool kids are definitely, like, there's different pockets of super cool kids talking to each other in different corners.
Yeah.
And you can kind of, and then there's, like, the outer ring. And it's very, it's interesting. But, yeah, it's a, but Twitter is funny. He's at J-O-H-N-D-E-V-O-R-E, John Devore. Where are you on Twitter, Anna David?
You know you follow me. I'm at Anna B. David. And you can also follow at After Party Chat.
Oh.
Oh yes!
How exciting!
Yes, tweet at us.
Yeah, dude.
Please. Okay, you're a delight. We're done.
Thank you.
Good.
You guys, don't you just want to take her in your little palm of your hands and cradle her or something like that? Sarah Benincasa, author, comedian, memoirist, novelist, all around great gal, storyteller. Go buy her book. Great. Follow her on Twitter, and in general, become a Benincasa-ette if you know what's good for you. I just made that up.